We're in the middle of a series entitled Lies Women Believe, and again, not a title that I came up with, but one that I liked so much when I saw it that I hijacked it from others. And so far, we've covered two of these lies. The first lie, my unbelief or disobedience is justified because of how difficult my life is. And we primarily looked at 1 Corinthians 10:13 in that message. And then secondly, I need God to change this about my life in order to be satisfied, in order to be content. And we primarily looked at Philippians 4 and Paul's teaching on contentment in that message. Well, that brings us now to lie number three that women tend to believe. And remember in my introduction, I said I reserve the right to modify my series as we keep going. So I did give you an original outline. But I said I might add or take away. Well, I'm going to apply that modification tonight. I'm going to add a new one that I didn't originally give you. So here's the lie we're going to talk about tonight. If the leadership in my life is weak, imperfect, ungodly, or I just simply disagree with it, it's okay to seek control. Yep. Yeah, it's kind of a long one. If the leadership in my life is weak, imperfect, ungodly, or I just simply disagree with it for whatever reason, it's okay to seek control. Now let me give you, just like we did last time, a few other ways this might sound in our language or in our inner dialogue. If he's not going to lead, someone's got to do it. If I don't resist that leadership, I'm complicit in it. If I don't resist it, that means I condone it. If I don't assert myself and challenge this leadership, nothing will change. Now, before we narrow in on women in particular, we should begin tonight by noting that this is a vulnerability for anyone under any kind of authority. You're obviously aware that women are not the only ones in Scripture called to submit. You're also aware that women are not the only ones who struggle to submit to imperfect, flawed, ungodly authority. For instance, submission to the government, that is a struggle for many Christians today, and in my experience, it would appear to be far more of a struggle for men than for women. Why is it a struggle? Well, not because the Lord hasn't been clear in what our obligations are, but because of the very lie that we're talking about tonight. If leadership is unreasonable, I don't have to come under it. I have to resist it. If a leader is ungodly in his ideology, if he's a promoter of evil, then I can't come under that because then I'm condoning it or I'm complicit in it. So everyone's vulnerable to this because everyone is called to submission, and this is what the human heart, this is the direction the human heart naturally goes with authority. Let me just give you rapid fire cross references here for just to show you the extent of submission and all the different, just a few of the ways that we're called to it. Romans 13:1, right? Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And those which exist are established by God. Titus 2:9, bondservants are to be submissive to their own masters in everything. They are to be well-pleasing, not argumentative. 1 Peter 2:13, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. 1 Peter 2:18, servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable. It speaks to that very lie there. If authority is unreasonable, I don't have to come under it. 1 Peter 5:5, you younger men, likewise, be subject to your elders, and all of you clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. So, again, that's just a sample. And we can note in every one of those references, the submission is done not because the one in authority is greater in essence, greater in personhood, but rather for the sake of order and structure. So when you think of authority and submission, think of functional order by divine decree. And the authority is a delegated authority. God has delegated that authority to those in that position. Now, even though everyone is called to this, we do know that there is a particular vulnerability for women because they have an additional structure, an additional authority structure in their lives that men don't have. And that is the context of marriage. So just narrowing it down to that marriage relationship, have you noticed how many times, how many passages just in the New Testament we see that theme come out? Ephesians 5:22, which we're going to look at tonight, among other passages. Colossians 3:18, Titus 2:5, 1 Peter 3:1. And we would recognize just one command, one reference, one passage would indicate that the flesh would naturally go against it. But when we see this, we see several imperatives, several different passages in the New Testament stressing the importance of submission. What's that telling us? Well, your flesh is going to be vulnerable to resisting the leadership that God has put in your life. You're going to be vulnerable to using your own wisdom, your own strength, your own human weapons, so to speak, to fight for control, to manipulate in order to get control, to usurp the authority God has put in your life. We're going to look at several passages tonight to address that very tendency and draw out why is that there? What's going on in the human heart to resist the leadership that God has placed in one's life? Now, there's going to be an emphasis on the marriage relationship tonight, not only because that's the context of most of the passages we're going to go to, but also because that's probably the typical, the majority of you in the room. But if you're not married, don't tune out, because the principles apply to any authority and submission relationship or context. So let's begin tonight by looking at Ephesians 5:22, probably the passage that your mind would instinctively go to on this topic. Ephesians 5:22. Paul writes, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord." Now, we're talking about that word submission a lot already. There we see it there. Be subject. What does that mean? What is the definition of that? Well, first, notice it's an act of the will. Wives, be subject. So it's something you're willing. You're putting yourself in a particular position. And therefore, we could define it this way. It's the voluntary response to God's will in giving up your own independence to come under the leadership of another. Let me give you two more definitions. John Piper, here's his definition. Submission is the divine calling of a wife to honor and affirm her husband's leadership and help carry it through according to her gifts. And probably the one that I like the most from Pastor Todd Murray. Willingly following a husband's leadership, believing that his authority has been delegated to him by God. And I like that definition because of those two words, willingly and believing. So willingly coming under his leadership, but then the faith required to do that in the way that God is honored by, believing that his authority, however imperfect, has been delegated to him by God. Todd also has a really helpful statement when it comes to this. And from a practical perspective, I think it sums up the essence of what this means. He uses the language, a demeanor of endorsement of leadership, a demeanor of endorsement of your husband's leadership, a supportive endorsement. What would that look like? Well, it would be your attitude, your speech, your verbal communication. It would be tone, nonverbal communication, body language, facial expressions, actions. And so think of submission as a demeanor of endorsement. And notice this command here in verse 22, it's in the present tense, so continually be submissive. It's a way of life. There's never a time when you're not called to this. But when I say that, you might think, well, wait a minute. Is that true? Am I always called to submit in any and every context? Let's talk for a moment about what submission isn't before we keep going. Not a gag order. It's not a gag order. It's not being quiet in the sense of, oh, I can't share my perspectives. I can't share my ideas. It's not equated with agreement, agreeing with your husband. The question isn't if you will disagree at times with his leadership. You definitely will. And sometimes you're going to be right. Your way would have been better. Absolutely. The question is, what does the Lord call you to when you do disagree? Or better yet, how are you supposed to disagree? How are you supposed to interact and relate? Furthermore, it's not a command to follow your husband or any leader indiscriminately, as in into sin. In other words, submission is not blindly, mindlessly just following every course of leadership, every directive your husband gives you. No, when a human authority that God has placed in your life, when that human authority leads you to violate God's authority, well then, in the language of Acts 5:29, you obey God rather than man. So there's a few things to help clarify what submission isn't. So back in the text here, notice in chapter 5, verse 22, this submission is to your own husband, not to every man. But be careful here that you're not comparing him to others, longing to be under the leadership of another husband, buying in maybe to this lie. I would be more submissive if I had that kind of leadership. No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't. Isn't it interesting how we flatter ourselves? It can be submission or any other area of obedience. We flatter ourselves by always imagining, if I was in a different set of circumstances, I'd be more faithful. Right? We're always willing to just give ourselves the benefit of the doubt. Take me out of this situation, put me in anyone else's, and I would be more godly. No, we wouldn't. How do we know that? Because the Lord ordained every single detail in your life to promote your Christ-likeness. That's Romans 8:28. All things work together for your good. What's the good? Christ-likeness. There isn't a better path for your godliness. This is the context. This is the scenario where you can be the most godly. So notice that language again. Your own husband. How's that going to help you there? He didn't make a mistake. As hard as it might be, as imperfect or even as ungodly as it might be, the Lord didn't make a mistake with it. He hasn't failed you. He didn't have a blind spot when he allowed you to get married to the particular leader you're married to. Notice also how the text begins. We're kind of backing up here, but wives, just the general statement, wives, all the wives in the church. Every Christian wife, regardless of her social standing, education, intelligence, maturity, giftedness, age, experience, any other consideration. And nor is it qualified by her husband, your own husband. Doesn't say anything about his intelligence, his character, attitude, spiritual condition, whether or not he's leading the way he's supposed to. What is it qualified by? Notice that last phrase, as to the Lord. How is that helpful? Because it shows you, I don't look to any particular leader. I don't look to a husband to find motivation to do this. I look to the Lord. My husband may not be worthy of submission, but the Lord always is. As to the Lord. Notice in verse 23, Paul's going to give you the reason. Why? Why are you called to do this? And he doesn't say this. Because your husband's always going to lead you well, wisely, faithfully. Now, what does he say? Verse 23. For the husband is the head of the wife. The husband is the head. That is to say, he's in a position to lead. Think about headship like this. The head gives direction, the body responds. And it's not that the husband makes himself the head. Notice, he is. He is the head. He's the leader, whether or not he acts like it. That's what he is. That's how the Lord made him. He was the one who was first created and given the divine mandate to lead. And this is patterned after that very creation account. But also patterned after redemption. Notice, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. Savior of the body. He provides the body, the church, with everything it needs, and he protects the church from her. He's the provider and protector. So among other things, we can see that your role in marriage, coming under authority, it has nothing to do with an ancient culture which viewed women as inferior to men. Rather, it has to do with creation and redemption, both of which transcend culture. Notice the extent of submission, verse 24. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be subject to their husbands in everything. So no part of her life should be outside of that relationship, every area of her life. Now, sometimes we look at that passage and we say, yeah, but verse 24 isn't true all the time, because my husband might prevent me from obeying Christ and try to lead me into sin, and I can't submit in everything in that sense. Well, that's true. And he's not saying follow your husband into sin here, but it's implicit in the text. There's a protection for you right here. Notice the comparison. As the church submits to Christ, there's your pattern. As the church submits to Christ, so also, in the same way, wives ought to be subject to their husbands in everything. Christ would never lead the church into sin. Christ would never prevent the church from obeying him. There's your pattern right there. It's right there in the text. Now, skip over to 5:33, where Paul sums up his exhortation to husbands and wives. Nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she, and you would expect him to say what? Submits. But instead he says, respects her husband. He's interchanged that word submission with respect. They aren't synonyms, but submission's not happening when there's no respect. That's why the language that we talked about earlier is so helpful. Think of submission as a disposition, a demeanor of honor, a demeanor of support and respect of your husband's leadership. That's a critical clarification, because the Lord is leading you through a weak, imperfect leader who's not always going to lead you in a way that's best. It might be foolish. He may be lazy, passive, sinful, even unbelieving, but submission isn't endorsing his leadership. It's a demeanor of endorsing it, no matter what it looks like. You don't have to agree with it. You often won't. You can express concerns, but you have to be resolved to respect and honor the position God has put him in. Now, before we move on to the next passage, I want you to notice a very important detail here. Back up to verse 21 for a moment. See that phrase, submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. And then in verse 22, Paul gives a prime example of this very submission. Wives, submit to your own husbands. Does anyone have a Bible version in verse 22 that does not say submit? It just says wives to your own husbands. No. All right. So they all added that word in, submit. Because in most of the earliest manuscripts, the word submit isn't there. It just says wives to your own husbands. And the Bible version appropriately supplies the verb submit. It's not that it's wrong, but it does tell us that idea of submitting is carried down from verse 21. Submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ, wives to your husbands. But for the grammarians in the room, you'll notice verse 22 can't stand by itself, wives to your husband, there's no verb. Verse 21 is a participle, submitting to one another in the reverence of Christ. So where's the main statement? Where's the main verb? We'll go all the way back to the end of verse 18. But be filled with the Spirit. And then he just launches with a bunch of participles. He's saying, here's the result. Here's the evidence of being filled with the Spirit. Verse 19, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody with your heart to the Lord, always giving thanks for all things in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ to God, even the Father, and submitting to one another in the fear of Christ. Wives to your own husbands. So notice that connection there. A Spirit-filled Christian is a singing Christian, a giving thanks Christian, and a submitting Christian. It's connected directly to being filled with the Spirit of God. So what does that detail tell us? How does that help you as a wife, or help you to submit to any authority in your life? It tells you that you don't have the resources within yourself to do what God has called you to do. It's only as you're filled with the Spirit. In other words, it's not natural. It's not going to make sense to the flesh. It's not going to be accomplished in the flesh. Now, you might be hearing this and saying, well, that's great for a Christian marriage, but my husband is an unbeliever, or at least acts like one. He certainly seems like he is. What am I supposed to do when the leadership God has placed in my life isn't just weak or imperfect, like all ladies have to deal with, but it's actually ungodly? It's unbelieving. Well, you have to first know that the Lord has accounted for your very situation. And here's your answer. You're called to the same standard that a wife married to a Christian man is called to. 1 Peter 3. It's our second passage for tonight. 1 Peter 3, 1 to 6. This is a passage that begins speaking to a Christian wife married to an unbeliever, but it applies to a marriage where you're equally yoked as well, because Abraham and Sarah are used as an example to illustrate the principle here. And so you're called to submit to imperfect leadership, like Abraham's leadership, like Sarah was called to do, or unbelieving leadership, like the husband we're going to see in verse 1. Look at 1 Peter 3, verse 1. In the same way, so what's that comparison? Well, if you were to back up in the context, Peter's been speaking of various submission to authority contexts, giving honor to those who are in authority. So in the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands. Same term, same construction as Ephesians 5. Continually be submissive. Line up under God's delegated authority. But now the passage gets different than Ephesians 5. Because Peter highlights a different purpose. We might even say an additional reason for your submission. So that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, and when you see that word, if, that condition, it's really when. It's the conditional language that assumes it's true. So when they are disobedient to the word, and that's not talking about a Christian husband who falls into sin, that's talking about they're characterized by disobedience. Continually, characteristically disobedient to the word. Now notice what he says. They may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives. One, converted, saved. You can look it out. Paul uses that in 1 Corinthians 9. 19 to 22, they might be converted without a word by the behavior of their wives. You might win them over to Christ. You see how this speaks directly to the lie that we're addressing tonight. The natural tendency when one is under imperfect or ungodly leadership is to do what? Nag, right? Argue, resist that leadership. But Peter tells you to influence that unbelieving husband in this way. In the words of one pastor, allow the eloquent silence of your life to be a powerful testimony. That's not a gag order. It's not talking about being quiet, never speaking to him. This is with reference to the truth and his leadership. He's disobedient to the word. He's hardened against the truth. You're not having interactions about the truth, about the scriptures. He wants nothing to do with it. And Peter is saying, when he silences the message of your lips, when he says, I never want to talk about this again with you, influence him with something that he can't silence, your life, your behavior. That's what he says. As they observe your chaste and respectful behavior, your pure, holy life, a life that has no explanation apart from the Spirit of God, and respectful. You respect and honor a man, a leadership that is by no means respectful, no means worthy of that respect and honor. And the Lord has promised to use your godly life as a powerful testimony in his life. But it's interesting what comes next in verse 3. Your adornment must not be merely external. Braiding the hair, wearing gold jewelry, or putting on dresses. Now, you don't have to shrink back in your seat tonight if you have braided hair or gold on anywhere, or you put on multiple dresses today. These are terms, first of all, depicting a lavish, excessive amount of time and energy and focus on one's appearance. Notice the plural, putting on of dresses, such as garments in the plural. You can imagine just a woman in front of a mirror just over and over, just putting it on for hours at a time. How do I look in this? How do I look in this? Just an excessive focus on the wardrobe. An inordinate amount of time and focus on outer beauty. Notice the word merely. Don't let your adornment merely be these things. He's not forbidding paying attention to looking nice, wearing nice things. That's not what he's talking about. Look at the contrast. But let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit. So naturally, you'll tend to be preoccupied with what comes naturally, external beauty. I'm going to focus on that. That's where I'm going to put all my attention and devotion to. And Peter isn't saying neglect that, avoid that, don't care at all about external beauty, but shift your focus so that predominantly it's on dressing up on the inside. Because unlike physical beauty and makeup and clothing, a godly heart is imperishable. Notice that word there. The imperishable quality. Imperishable. This isn't measured in hours and minutes. It's not measured by saying, well, how much time do I spend in front of the mirror? How much time do I do this? But those things aren't irrelevant. You know, you could ask yourself how much time, effort, and energy goes into that which is perishable. My body, my clothing, my makeup, versus how much time, effort, and energy goes into that which transfers to eternity, my godliness. What is the godliness in this context? Peter says, a gentle and quiet spirit. Now, it's got nothing to do with noise, whether or not you're talking. Notice, it's a spirit, a disposition. It's a demeanor. It's exactly the opposite of the fleshly tendencies that come out when you're resisting it or trying to get control. What are the fleshly tendencies that come out toward leadership or toward your husband when you don't want to come under his leadership for whatever reason it might be? What does that look like? Well, you know the signs. You can get quarrelsome, argumentative, contentious. You can get accusatory and start using superlatives. Right? You never do this. You always do that. You can project your fears onto him and try to get him to be anxious along with you about whatever you're fearing. And then accuse him, well, you don't care if he won't get anxious like you do. You can criticize his leadership and his provision. Well, what is that speaking about? Well, you remember the Proverbs? There's several Proverbs that talk about a wife with a quarrelsome spirit or a contentious spirit. Let me read a few of them to you. Proverbs 21:9. It's yeah. Proverbs 21:9. It's better to live in a corner of a roof than a house shared with a contentious woman. Why? Why? Maybe she can't be reasoned with, and she's irrational, quarrelsome, doesn't have that gentle and quiet spirit here that Peter's talking about. 10 verses later, Proverbs 21:19. Now listen, it goes from, notice the location. It's better to live in a desert land than with a contentious and vexing, a provoking woman. Commentator John Kitchen writes this. The husband's preferable dwelling of verse 9, the corner of the roof, has now become a desert land. This is describing an uninhabited area devoid of fruit, water supply, or anything desirable and necessary. Such a place is completely undesirable and normally considered nearly uninhabitable, yet compared with a contentious woman, the desert land looks like a well-watered oasis to the frustrated man. I had to quote a commentator, so you didn't blame me for saying that. One more, Proverbs 27:15. A constant dripping on a day. You know it's coming. A constant dripping on a day of steady rain and a contentious woman are alike. What's the idea there? Unrelenting, right? Unrelenting, just a constant state of pushing back. I'm not budging. I'm going to get my way. I'm going to get control. So these Proverbs are speaking to those vulnerabilities that are there in the human heart. And Peter is showing you, here's the pathway to guard yourself from that. It's back to 1 Peter 3, verse 4. Notice when you have that gentle and quiet spirit, the opposite of what we just read in Proverbs. It's precious in the sight of God, extremely valuable, highly esteemed in the eyes of God. Not in the eyes of your husband or the leader that you're struggling with. He may not recognize its worth. Others around, especially if it's in the context of your marriage and the privacy of your home, they're not going to see that. It's not going to be in their eyes. This is where only God can see and recognize, and it's precious, highly esteemed. What's that telling you? He's near, he's aware, and he is very pleased when you live out these principles in the presence of an unbelieving husband. Peter gives examples now, verse 5. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also. So not being called to anything that all godly ladies of all time have been called to. The holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. Verse 6, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her children if you do what's right without being frightened by any fear. Now, calling him Lord there, that's master. That's just an example of the language of respect and honor in the ancient context. But what I want to highlight here in verses 5 to 6, that relationship between hoping in God and fear. Hoping in God and fear. Notice verse 5, the holy women hoped in God. A confident expectation. A certainty that the promises of God are true. They didn't hope in their circumstances changing for the better, or hope in their husbands getting their act together, or hope in their own wisdom to manipulate and achieve some temporary outcome. Their hope and confidence was in God, which means unbelief is the enemy of submission. Specifically, the unbelief of fear. Fear. Notice how it ends. If you do what is right without being frightened by any fear. Frightened by anything that terrorizes you, that makes you anxious. Fear is often, not always, but often, the enemy of submission. That tells you that when you're afraid, you're not going to have that quiet and gentle spirit. You won't be able to come under what Peter is calling you to here. When you're afraid, you've got to hope in God. You've got to resist that tendency to go and get control, to usurp that authority that God has put in your life. You've got to hope in God and have that submissive demeanor. This is an incredible connection to recognize. If you find yourself struggling with that in the home, recognize the connection between fear and submission. Think about in your own life the times that you've sought control or maybe had that argumentative spirit. Try to identify the fear that's behind that, that's motivating you to act like that. Is it a fear about finances, a fear about children, the well-being of the children, your own spiritual health, the spiritual health of the children, whatever it might be? You've got to identify that fear, and you'll recognize when you deal with that fear, you're not going to fall into some of those tendencies that we read about in Proverbs. All right, one more passage for tonight. 1 Timothy 2. Now we're going out of the marriage context into the church. First Timothy 2:9. Don't ask me anything about Hebrews at the end because I just lost the page. Okay, 1 Timothy 2:9. Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments, but rather by means of good works, as is proper for women making a claim to godliness. Back up to verse 9. Look at that word for adorn. That's cosmeo. Sounds a lot like cosmetics, right? That's the arranging things in an ordering in an ordered way, drawing out the natural beauty of something, ordering it, arranging it to look its best. And Paul says this is to be done with proper clothing, appropriate, well-ordered, modestly and discreetly. So modestly, that's just referring to having a regard for others, thinking about, is this appropriate? Is this going to be best? Is this the most loving thing to loving way for me to adorn myself in light of whom I'm going to be around? The second word, discreetly, is that idea of moderation and self-control. So I have my desires under control so as not to draw attention to myself. And then he gives a culturally relevant application in verse 9. Not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments. Wow, that sounds remarkably similar to Peter, right? Except here, braided hair refers to elaborate, excessive, even a luxurious hairstyle. Because they would weave together the gold and even put pearls in it, which were more costly than gold. And costly garments, luxurious clothing. So unlike Peter, where it was just excessive, here it's luxurious. It's kind of the flaunting of oneself. Look at me. Look at how wealthy I am. The pride of life, John would call it in 1 John 2. So again, not forbidding giving attention to your appearance, but speaking to the issue of arranging yourself externally with the goal of attracting attention. Could be attracting the attention of men, or it could be competing with other women. Sometimes a parent or a husband or another lady might give counsel to a woman about their appearance, and it sounds like this. You've got to dress this way. You've got to dress modestly because you don't want to draw your attention to yourself because men have issues, right? And certainly that is one of the main principles. We should be considering love and protecting others from making them vulnerable. But that's half of the matter. As I've heard it put by a pastor friend of mine, it's not merely dress modestly because men have lust issues. It's ladies, dress modestly or you have pride issues. Because you could be wanting to draw attention to yourself. So Paul gives a contrast now. If the ladies are not to be preoccupied with attention-seeking adornment, what is to be their focus? But rather by means of good works, as is proper for women making a claim to godliness. Her beauty can't be limited to her physical appearance. She's to adorn herself, to order herself with good works. And that's just the Christian life, the whole spectrum of obedience to Christ Jesus. So Paul's saying to ladies in a culture very much like ours, don't be known for your looks. Don't be known for those things. If people are drawn to you, if they're attracted to you, it should be your character, your godly life. Now notice the direction this text goes in verse 11. A woman must quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. Now, you see that word quietly there. I don't want you to misunderstand that. Go back to chapter 2, verse 1 of this same letter. He uses the same word here. First of all, then I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men, for kings and all who are in authority, so that we may lead a tranquil and quiet, there's the word, quiet life in all godliness and dignity. Quiet there. Does that mean Christians, as we live in this world, don't make any noise? No. Rather, what's the idea? You're going to live an undisturbed, peaceful life because you didn't go and agitate authorities, right? You didn't rebel against civil authorities. And it's the same idea back in our passage. It's not saying when the church is gathered, women can't make noise or talk. The context is quietness in the sense of I'm not going to assert myself. I'm not going to try to lead. I'm not going to take control, take the place of where men are called to lead in the church. It's the quietness of coming under authority with that demeanor of endorsement. With entire or complete submissiveness. And then he just applies verse 12. He applies verse 11 in verse 12. But I don't allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. Context here is public worship. That's 1 Timothy 2. Public worship. And notice, over a man. So context and gender here become critical to understand this. There's nothing forbidding women to teach at all, depending on the context. Titus 2:3, they're to teach what is good to the younger women. But teach here, in our passage, that word for teach, that's not the same word as teach in Titus 2. In fact, this verb for teach, when used in the pastoral epistles, it's always used to refer to teaching, that the public authoritative proclamation to the church. You can look at chapter 4, verse 11, chapter 6, verse 2 for that. Nowhere in the New Testament is a woman in such a role or functioning in that way. You have women teaching one another, women teaching their children. You do have Priscilla and Aquila. Remember, they took Apollos aside in Acts 18 and helped round out some of his theology. But this corporate, authoritative, doctrinal instruction to the people of God when the church meets, Paul is forbidding women to have that role. So he's basically saying you're not to teach or lead or govern. Practically speaking, you're not to be an elder, and you're not to function like an elder. But rather, she is to remain quiet. Again, that's not talking about noise. That's not the issue here. It's quiet in the sense of I'm not going to step into leadership roles. Now, the Spirit of God's wisdom here is shown, and he knew a statement like that would need some extra backing. And so Paul gives a theological defense for this principle, and it's grounded first in the creation account. Notice verse 13. For it was Adam who was first created, and then Eve. Very important here, because some try to say, well, this passage was just for the ancient context in Ephesus, which demeaned women, and Paul hadn't really been liberated from that yet. Well, notice, he grounds it in creation pre-fall, before sin. Before sin. God's perfect and good design, authority and submission are not the result of the fall. They're abused because of the fall. They're not a result of it. God created man first, put him in the garden, gave him responsibility over the garden. He then created woman as a partner and helper to assist him. She was made to follow his lead. Think about this. Could he not have created them at the same time? That would have been nothing for him. Why create man first and then woman? Because of his design. He wanted to demonstrate the good and wise design in his actions. And so what's the point here in verse 13? The order of creation should be reflected in the church. So let not a woman enter into the sphere for which God has not designed for her to be. And now, what's he going to say in verse 14? Let me show you what happens when the creation order is not maintained. Verse 14. And, so here's another statement. Another reason for his I don't allow women to teach or have authority over man. And it was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. Now, remarkably, here is how some treat this passage. They actually think that it's Eve. It's the woman who looks worse here in this. So they're saying basically women shouldn't be elders, teachers. They shouldn't have any spiritual influence in the church because they're more vulnerable to deception just by the fact that they're women. That's how some treat that. Paul's just giving us a testimony here on the gullible nature of women. They're just not as smart. They're not as discerning as men, so they can't teach. Well, that's not the case. It's not what he's doing. And first of all, that can't even match, I don't know about your experience, but it certainly doesn't match my experience. When I was in school, who messed up the grading curve on every test? It was the girls who were scoring so much better than the boys. We always wanted our own grading curve, separate from the girls. One author said this, "What man has not been outthought, outtalked, outdone by his female counterparts?" Your experiences need be no larger than your family to know women who are superior to their fathers, brothers, and husbands. Yeah, he's right. So if he's not saying women are more prone to deception, why, what's he saying here? You know, or let's say this, if he is saying that, if he is just saying women are more gullible, why would we give them any influence? Why let them teach children? Why let them teach fellow women if they're just prone to deception? It's not what it means. Remember, Paul's drawing from the Genesis account here. So let's turn back to Genesis and look at the details. Genesis 3, verse 1. Genesis 3, verse 1. Keep your spot in 1 Timothy 2 because we're coming back. Now the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, notice what Satan does. Targets the woman because he hates God's design. Indeed, as God said, you shall not eat from any tree of the garden. The woman said to the serpent, now here's what she should have done. Right here. Hold that thought. Let me grab Adam. You can interact with him. That's what she should have done. Instead, she dialogues with the serpent. From the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat, but from the fruit of the tree which is in the middle of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat from it or touch it or you will die. So Adam had passed it on to her. She knew the instructions that the Lord had given to Adam. Verse 4, the serpent said to the woman, you surely will not die, for God knows that in the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate. She gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. See that last phrase there, her husband with her? That could mean he was with her the whole time. As she's interacting with the serpent, he's just standing right there doing nothing. But it also could mean that some time passed between verse 5 and verse 6. See, when the woman saw, as if she continued to reflect on this, and when she saw that it was like this, then she got Adam involved. I lean toward the view that some time had passed between verse 5 and 6. Why do I say that? Because if Adam was there with Eve the whole time listening to the serpent, then he was deceived right along with her. And that's not what Paul says in 1 Timothy 2. Also, it means he just stood by and said nothing. He sat there and watched Eve and the serpent interact. But notice when the curses come out, how the Lord rebukes them, what he says. Look at chapter 3, verse 17 in Genesis. What's he say to Adam here? Because you've listened to the voice of your wife. What's he say to Eve? Because you listened to the serpent. Right? Adam listened to Eve. Eve listened to the serpent. By the way, that's why Adam's responsible for the fall. Every time the fall is blamed throughout the scripture, it's always on Adam. It's not on Eve. The fall was a result of disobeying God's command to not eat the fruit. But what was going on at that same time? They reversed their roles. They reversed their roles. So, what happened in Genesis 3 as it relates to Paul's point in 1 Timothy? Go back to 1 Timothy now. Eve assumed leadership. She stepped into a role of the leader and man followed. So look at verse 14 again. It was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. Adam looks worse. In 1 Timothy 2 and Genesis 3. He wasn't deceived. He did it high-handedly. He looks worse. Adam didn't deal directly in that account with Satan. It was his wife who was deceived by the serpent. What's the point here? Why is he bringing that up? When God's design is abandoned, it brings devastating consequences. Eve's sin involved overturning the order of creation and leading her husband. She put herself in that position of authority and reversed God's good ordering of creation. Why is Paul bringing that up right here? He's giving a reason. What's the theological basis for how I can say I don't allow a woman to be an elder? It's basically what he's saying. Well, why? Why is that? Because look what happens when she comes out from God's appointed role in her life. Look what happens when she tries to take on a role that God didn't create her to take on. God didn't design her to take on that role. When she grasps for authority, when she tries to lead, when she functions as a leader, which God didn't make her to be, she then is vulnerable to deception. That is when she's vulnerable. When she steps out of that protection, out of that out of the role that she's supposed to be in. So Paul is showing Timothy here in the account of the fall. Here's a tragic illustration of what happens when a wife usurps authority and tries to take that role on herself. Now, you might want details about the rest of that passage if you're curious in the following verses. I did teach this several years ago. It's on the website, so you can find my notes, and it'll explain all those details there. But just by way of conclusion, let's revisit the lie that we introduced our time together tonight. If leadership in my life is weak, imperfect, ungodly, or I disagree, it's okay for me to assume that role. It's okay for me to get control. It's okay for me to challenge it, to be contentious, to resist it. Well, when you're tempted with thoughts like that, you've got to go back to the passages we looked at tonight and crush those temptations with the truth. God makes no mistakes in giving you the leadership that He has given you in your life. And He makes no mistakes in calling you to come under that leadership as well. He knows it's imperfect at best. He knows that. Have you ever noticed in all of the passages, and I think it's all, I could be wrong, but it's most of the passages that talk about obeying an authority, right after it, that authority is addressed. Here's how you're supposed to be. Think about it. Romans 13, then it gives you the ideal for the government. Ephesians 5, 22, then it talks about what a husband's supposed to be. 1 Timothy 2 here, and then it talks about what elders are supposed to be like right after this. The Lord knows that. He puts the high burden on the leader in that, but at the same time, He knows it's going to be imperfect, and He knows that vulnerability. And so anytime you're struggling with that, you've got to go back to these passages and crush those things. The Lord accounted for all those things in His Word. So, all right. Questions from tonight?
Married women obviously shouldn't step outside of their role of submission and make those decisions, do those things. Okay? Single women.
Mm-hmm.
They're obviously in that role. They don't have a husband either.
Mm-hmm.
Widowed or never married.
Yep.
So in some cultures, obviously, it would be their fathers,
yep,
that would still control them. Or in some Asian cultures, the oldest son,
mm-hmm,
the widow situation, would make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
What would be your advice in the Western cultures?
Yeah, so for us? Mm-hmm. Yeah, for a widow or just a single lady, you're saying? Well, the issue would be you're not going to be, in a marriage context, you're not going to be vulnerable to any of these things. It's not that you're... The issue isn't that you're not able to think through things and make decisions yourself. It's leadership. So you're not, if you're single, for whatever reason you're single, you're not leading a man. You're not usurping an authority. There is no man over you in the marriage context. So you just have those passages, particularly about marriage, are dormant for you. Just as a young single person preparing for marriage, those passages become alive as soon as they get married, but they're dormant until they get married. So there are particular passages as it relates to marriage that don't apply. So you just then would come into the context that everyone else is in with regard to the other authority and submission structures that are in place. So government, church leadership, just all of the things, employee, employer, as we would apply the slave and master relationship there in the New Testament. So So you just wouldn't have those passages wouldn't be applicable to you.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I've heard of some churches where,
yeah,
they, let's say on the edge, kind of fringe churches,
uh-huh,
where now if you're single, then the elders tell you what to do in everything.
Not like marriage, like in your home life? Like,
yeah. Any, yeah, financial decisions, anything that a husband would be involved in, they will take that role.
Yeah, so what I would do with that is I'd be pushing back on the detail. Well, first, you have zero warrant to say that in the New Testament. You have any passage you could go to. And secondly, why do we see that language in 1 Peter 3 and Ephesians 5? To your own husband, not to all men. And so I'm sure they would have a they'd use a hermeneutical crowbar and get around those passages somehow, but obviously we would disagree with that controlling leadership approach. Yeah. You can see the language that is even used in the marriage passages. A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. You know, and so what does that mean? It means you're free from those particular responsibilities or obligations if the marriage covenant is no longer in place. So, yeah. If you have a friend or ever in an environment like that, it's time to leave. If elders are micromanaging a personal life like that. Now, if a woman is coming and saying, I would appreciate your wisdom and help in these things, and they're helping her through it, fine, but not as a matter of obedience and exercising their authority as leaders. Yeah.
What would you say to churches that justify women preachers using the example of Priscilla?
Yeah, the example of Priscilla. So when she and her husband talked to Apollos, say the preaching language isn't used there. I interact with women all the time about theology, and I'm helped and sharpened by it, and I rejoice in that. There's no issue about interacting with the opposite gender and females talking theology and asking questions and that. So to use that to justify preaching, you're taking quite a leap, because it doesn't use the terminology of preaching. That's a conversation that the three of them were having. It wasn't a worship service. It's not the authoritative public doctrinal instruction. It's just a husband and wife helping someone out with their theology. That happens all the time. I rejoice in that. But you're going far beyond scripture by using that as an example to justify women being in pulpits. Yeah.